Hello, welcome to Blue Talk, the very first attractions industry podcast from Blue Loop. I'm Owen Ralph, and over the next 50 or so minutes, we'll be talking to Jan Roovers from Compagnie des Alpes about Walibi theme park hotels and Disneyland Paris.
A lot of people don't know, but where there's the parking lot right next to the Newport Bay, it's supposed to be the location of the third gate.
Jamie Christen from Chester Zoo in England will be telling us about the massive £40 million islands project.
It's a massive step change for us at Chester, and we know it's the largest investment in any zoo in the UK.
Blue Loop's very own Charlie Reid will be here to tell us about the Blue Loop Live conferences in London and also Hong Kong. But first, I dropped in on the Coronation Street tour in Manchester, England, to catch up with Juliana Delaney, CEO of the Continuum Group. Now, for fans of the show, like myself, you might be interested to know we did the interview in an office right above Carl O'Connor's Knicker Factory. Juliana, we're here today in Coronation Street, the tour. Just tell me a little bit more about the attraction.
Yes, it's a fantastic sunny day in Manchester, which you don't get very often, but it's always sunny on Coronation Street, the tour. We opened this last April in 2014, and it's been a roaring success. Initially only for a six-month run, but it's now been extended all the way through 2015. Essentially, we invite people to come in to see some of the Coronation Street sets in our studio, our indoor studio, and then out onto the street itself, which was used for filming the famous soap opera for over 30-odd years. So it's an absolute joy for people who've been huge fans, and maybe even those who aren't fans, to step out onto those hallowed cobbles.
And it's quite different to a normal studio tour, isn't it? Do you know of any other studio tours that are just centred on one programme, one show?
Well, I don't know any studio tours in the UK that are featuring television programmes like this. Yes, you've got others that are about films, like The Making of Harry Potter, but I think this is a fairly unique one.
And how did you become, as Continuum, become involved with the project?
It began with a phone call. Yeah. It began with a phone call from ITV, who very tentatively wanted to know if we as a business were interested in taking over the set when it was finally sort of used, and they moved the filming to the new set at Media
City.
Yeah,
new set, isn't it?
Yeah, to see whether we wanted to open it as a visitor attraction and at all. They had the intellectual property, they had the brand of Coronation Street, and we have the expertise to run visitor attractions. So one phone call resulted in a very quick turnaround, and 6 months later we opened Coronation Street the tour. Probably just a bit longer than that, but not very much longer than that in terms of a turnaround.
And it has got a limited stay, hasn't it?
Yeah, runs till the end of this year.
Right.
Then it's away.
And that's because the site's going to be built on.
Yes, it's widely known that ITV moved out of this site in the heart of Manchester out to Media City, and the site is now the property of a developer with the City of Manchester, and they're going to put a mixed-use development on it. So, yeah, Coronation Street, the outdoor set, will go in 2016.
And just tell me about some of the visitor numbers. I know it's been very successful for you, hasn't it?
Yeah, before we opened, we'd had bookings of over 120,000 ticket sales.
Yeah.
And we did well over 400,000 in the first period. And we're now running at around, it's as successful as we had hoped it would be this in its second year. Very successful visitor numbers. What has been impactful is its effect on the Manchester economy, where they've shown that the added value of Coronation Street is into the multi-millions. In terms of having an attraction like this, than the extra spending that it's brought to the city. So positive for everybody. Positive for ITV with its brand, positive for the visitors who love coming, and positive for the city and for us as well as the company.
Now, there was actually a visitor attraction on this site 10 or 20 years ago, wasn't there?
You're obviously older than you look. It closed around 2000, and it was called Granada Studios, and it had lots of different television programme elements to it, but the main one was definitely Coronation Street, because visitors were allowed to walk on the street when they weren't filming. However, filming of Coronation Street went to 5 days a week, and then they couldn't take the visitors and the general public anymore, so it closed.
But there was more than just the studio.
Yeah, there was. Yeah. There were things like the 10 Downing Street set that had come from, I think it was the House of Cards. There was the Borrowers, the sets from the Borrowers, a successful ITV programme. So there was definitely more here. But actually, it's Coronation Street that brought them here. That was definitely the draw.
Now, you started out in the industry with Heritage Attractions, which might seem very different to what you're doing now. Just tell us about that and how you progressed to where you are now.
Actually, I've been in the industry for 30-odd years, and we as a company began with the Jorvik Viking Centre in York. So culture can stretch from Viking history right through to Coronation Street. I think they're both cultural stories in their own right. And interestingly, they're both streets as well, because Jorvik was all about a Viking street, a Viking age street in York. And as we've just discussed, Coronation Street is very much the modern street story.
And just quickly go through the full portfolio of attractions and what you know.
How much time have you got? Right, let's start with Edinburgh. We've got an underground visitor attraction called Mary King's Close in Edinburgh, the hidden history of the city. We've got York's chocolate story. We've got Oxford Castle, an amazing project in the centre of Oxford, unlocked only in the last 8 years or so. We have got we've got Canterbury Tales in Canterbury, the story of Chaucer and medieval England. We've got a farm park in Kent called Kent Life, and we've also got the Spinnaker Tower in Portsmouth, overlooking the dockyard, 170 metre high viewing tower, one of the Federation of Great Towers of the World, in fact. And then we've got Coronation Street, where we're sitting today. So seven successful visitor attractions, culture from one end of the country to the other.
Now, one thing I think you're proud of is making money out of heritage attractions or history attractions. How do you do that when maybe other people don't?
Actually, I think we're really proud that we're a successful company. And to be a successful company, you've got to have a turnover and you've got to have a profit. And we are able to make a profit out of running cultural attractions commercially. And that's good, because we may have capital expenditure that comes from Heritage Lottery funds or Millennium funds, or from our own commercial funding of a project like Chocolate. But actually, we're able to operate them and pleasantly extract money out of our visitors and make a profit for the company. And also put something back into the cities that we work with as well.
And York is your headquarters, isn't it?
Yeah, we've got a really strong association with the city of York because of its heritage and its culture. And actually the whole industry that's grown up around visitor attractions and museums in the city. It's a little sort of subculture of people who are designing and building sets and running and operating visitor attractions. So we're very proud of our Yorkshire roots, and it's, even though we operate all over the country and outside the UK as well, we're proud to call Yorkshire home.
Tell us about the Chocolate Story, which is your newest attraction in York, isn't it?
That goes back a little while as well, because it was an idea that was first mooted probably about 20 years ago, that the then Rowntree's chocolate factory wanted to do the story of the confectionery industry in the city. So it took us 20 years to come round to actually finding the location in King's Square, brilliant location in the centre of York, right on the footfall, and finding the money, the funding, which came from our company, to build the story of confectionery making, including chocolate, in York. And of course, we called it Chocolate, York's Chocolate Story. That was the pull.
And that's because there's manufacturers such as Nestle,
Terry's. Now it's Nestle, it was Terry's, it was Rowntree's, it was the Cravens, Mint Humbug factories. You turn left in York and you could smell Polo mints, you turn right in York and you could smell chocolate oranges. And so we wanted to capture some of that flavour and that aroma of industry, which at its height employed thousands and thousands of people. And actually, we also knew that people love chocolate.
And you don't discount heavily, is that right?
I've got a bit of a kind of thing about pricing. If you price it fairly, yes, there's always going to be times when large volume groups come along and you offer a discount. Yeah, there's always going to be times when it's a Wednesday in January and you need to bolster numbers. But I'm very much for fair pricing and not discounting too much.
Would you look at flexible pricing, dynamic pricing?
Dynamic pricing has been a really interesting topic, and I think that's different from discounting. Dynamic pricing is saying we've got a peak here, so let's sweat that period of the year, and actually we've got lower times, lower capacity times, and actually let's use pricing to create volume in those times. So dynamic pricing is interesting. What I don't like is high prices and then wholesale discounting. Mm. The number of people you see walking into certain theme parks who have got their bundle of toilet rolls under their arms, which bring them the coupons that get them in for half price. I don't like that way of doing business.
It's a question we're going to be asking everybody on the podcast. What kind of attractions do you like to visit with your own family when you get the time?
Yeah, actually I love visiting attractions. Even though I spend Monday to Friday doing what everybody else pays to do at the weekend, I love visiting attractions. I've gone through dragging my children to museums so that they could spot a market segment at a mile, through to being a granny and now taking
Which you really don't look old enough for, do you?
Oh, you smooth talker. Yeah, but it puts me in another market altogether now. So I'm now looking at what entertains and what represents good value for money for the extended family. So I love going to all sorts of aquariums. I love going to visitor attractions that are aimed at children. And I love museums as well, because I think there's so much that even small children of four can get out of visiting museums.
And just finally, you're speaking at Blue Loop Live this May, which may already have gone by the time some
days,
people hear this. Yeah.
Days away.
What can people expect, or what will they listen to?
Well, I'm on a panel that includes some of my peers. I believe we're talking about, or we will have talked about, for those who watch listening to the repeat, we'll be talking about our own business strategies and how we see the future of the industry. So yeah. I'm excited to be listening to what other people say, as well as sharing with the audience what I think our strategy will be for the next few years.
Look forward to seeing you there.
We'll be hearing a little bit more from Juliana later on in the podcast. Our next guest, Jan Roovers, was for 7 years the director of Company des Alpes' Northern Leisure Park division. We spoke to him recently from his home in the Netherlands. Thanks for joining us, Jan. Now, your career in the theme park industry started about 25 years ago as part of the pre-launch team at Disneyland Paris. That was in at the deep end, wasn't it?
Well, I was hired because I have an experience in North America. And I was trained at the hotel school in Lausanne, so I spoke French as well. And I had a desire to go back to Europe. Sanjay Varma, at that time, the director setting up the hotel division of Euro Disney at the time, he found me in North America and asked me to come over with him to Disney to open. And of course, that's a big challenge because it's 5,500 rooms, all of the ones pretty well at the same time opening up with a difference of a couple of weeks. And once you get involved in Disney, the first thing that happened with me, I had to do a 6 month of training in Florida. So I looked at all the parks, I looked at all the hotels, I looked at the way they worked, the whole thing. So at that moment, I got kind of bitten by the park entertainment business right across through the hotels.
And there were no other theme park hotels in Europe at this time, at least not on this scale, were there?
No, this scale is quite unusual. As a matter of fact, it's still in the world a big scale to open it all at one time, particularly because it was driven by only one park and not several other parks. I think they made a smart move by putting it next to Paris, although a lot of people asked a lot of questions about that. But Paris remains one of the very top tourist locations in the world. So once you have an opportunity to put it somewhere in Europe, you may as well put it in the top location. It's like you put your Burger King if you have the franchise, you could put it somewhere, put it right next to McDonald's, or at least close by.
Now, with 7 hotels and 2 theme parks, Disneyland Paris is recognised as a resort. But it's not uncommon for some parks, single parks, who had just 1 hotel and then call themselves a resort. Is that really a resort, do you think?
Well, it depends a little bit, in my opinion, what you do, what you offer as additional services. Because if it's just a hotel with a restaurant to feed the parks, then it's difficult to call it resort. I think you have to also add the swimming pool that is large enough to do other things. You have to have a health club. You have to have sport facilities. You have to do a number of things before you call yourself really a resort. But today, I think once you have a very decent offer, and you have alternative things also to do in the direct neighborhood, you can call yourself a resort. Yeah, that's stretching maybe the imagination, but right now, the most parks, if they want to appeal to a destination or to want to appeal to customers that come from a farther distance than 2 or 3 hours drive, you must have a hotel in order to attract them to your business.
You returned to the Netherlands in 2004 to work for several years at the Dolphinarium, and then that then led on to a wider role within Company des Alpes, didn't it, overseeing the Walibi brand and several other parks?
Well, basically, the Dolphinarium I stayed for about 3 years, and then I did for about 2.5 years. I went to Walibi, and there, of course, you saw a different thing, that Walibi was very much overbuilt originally by Six Flags as far as the number of attractions is concerned, and we had to bring that the number of attractions down in order to balance off the cost of operating compared to the potential in the market.
This is Walibi Holland, wasn't it?
It's Walibi, now called Walibi Holland, correct. And and basically we agreed to Company des Alpes to reinvest again in the boomerang, which we then did, and added a sound effect on it, which was quite new. That was the only ones at that time, and the boomerang would sound like we have it right now. And that really that was a turning point of that that park, to really bring it into line with what people expect a park of that nature should be. There were several other parks. Hellendoorn was another one I had under me under that reach at that time. A successful little park. But when the company decided to take a whole series of smaller parks, they had to add a few winners as well with it. And this is one of them, together with Saint-Malo in France. So that was one, and then we had, Fort Fun, which is a German park. It's a neat little park in Germany, does about 300,000 visitors a year, but there too has a real maintenance challenge, and they have to spend a lot of money every time on repairing and fixing things, and there is relatively little money for new development. That park is still up for sale, by the way. There was another one in England, okay, Pleasurewood Hills. You are not unfamiliar with that one, I think. It's a park that does that is an interesting one, because it has a relative good potential in the market where it is, and it's only really a pure summer operation. Very difficult to run that park. Was sold as well to Looping. So those were the 5 parks I had under me, and then of course later at the second stage, when the other parks got sold, I was asked to take on Walibi Belgium and Bellewaerde.
You mentioned some of the other parks being sold. The focus now is very much focusing on some of those larger properties, such as Walibi and Park Asterix, isn't it?
You know, a large company like that, that is basically focused very much on financial reasons and is looking at a result every 3 months. Smaller parks do not add much to those results. Park Asterix fits in that, as well as Futuroscope fits in that. Walibi Holland, Walibi Belgium, the same. So that's why they invested, did some more investment in the 2 Walibis in Holland and in Belgium recently.
To rebrand the Walibi parks, some new characters, some homegrown IP was developed. How successful do you think that's been?
I've always maintained that the whole development of Walibi, the new Walibi brand, should have most probably done based on two switches. One is first make a movie, which costs a lot of money up front, and then make the product popular and then introduce it into the parks. Okay, and then second, if you do it, you have to really set up the right amount of money for it aside. And both of those things were not as well done, in my opinion, as they should have been in Company des Alpes.
More recently, you've been working on Company des Alpes international expansions. We already know about Park Sindibad in Morocco, which hopefully should open later this year. What can you tell us about some of the other projects?
They have not signed up any particular parks outside of Sindibad. They are working with a number of different players that I know of. There's an indoor park that they're looking at to develop and operate in like more of a family entertainment center in Brussels. I know they are dealing with someone in Portugal. That is an interesting proposition. Whether they will continue that or not, I don't know. Now, the other little brand that has developed very well for Compagnie des Alpes is Grévin. Grévin is a kind of a Madame Tussauds, but then far more with a local appeal. And they have had a very big success with that Madame Tussauds, the original one that's already there for, I believe, 90 years in Paris. And they have opened one in Montreal, opened one in Prague. And they're looking at opening one now in Seoul, in South Korea. Merlin has got, with Madame Tussauds, a big handle on that market. But, you know, they have a huge size, and they have a very good structure. And we have a smaller size, or our company is up as a smaller size and a smaller structure, although it has a high potential of doing well in a number of smaller locations in big markets. But what is interesting, Compagnie des Alpes has to make up its mind what they want to do with that in the long run, because it's a bit of an unusual duck in a pond where traditionally, if they want to get rid of the smaller operations on one side, they do keep this brand on the other side.
Do you think the consolidation that we've had in Europe over the last 10, 15 years has been a good thing?
Generally, I think so, because most of the smaller family parks have a hard time getting more money to reinvest under the present financial climate. It's not said it's impossible, because you see that Efteling in Holland, which is not a family park, but it's a private organization, doesn't owe anything to anyone. You have Toverland, which is a private operation, which is owned by a large construction company owner. You have recently Jumble that opened up for 26 million, a smaller park, and that is close to MacArthur Glen, so it's right next to another market. So there is room for smaller players, but I think the large ones, if they have their act together and know what they're doing, and they mostly do, they will be successful in the long run, because Europe wants to have entertainment around them. It's a very mature product.
Now, Disneyland Paris, the main park, still has visitor numbers that most people in Europe would kill for, but still loses money. Why do you think that is?
First of all, they have a really tough time because of the beginning. And if you have a very rough time in the beginning, remember, they opened with a very high developed price. In other words, their expected opening price was around the 325 French francs, and they had to bring it down under the 200 French francs in order to get finally the volume rolling on that. Okay, so that was the one thing. The second part is that they planned to sell the hotels right after opening to get the cash for the second gate. And that never happened, because at that time nobody wanted to take it anymore. Okay, and the third thing is they did overspend, okay, in the building of the Magic Kingdom. And in itself, that's not a big problem, because Disney has always overcome that. It's been many, many years before Disney in Florida ever make money. Only Tokyo is the very unusual one, starting to make money right in the first 2 years of operation, or three, whatever. The reason I think they still have a challenge now is that they had a lot of negative publicity on it. That is true. And they had to write off twice big numbers before finally Disney took it over themselves. And they have, as a whole, in my opinion, really moved their prices down relatively low in order to guarantee the volumes. And you come to a very dangerous point where if you go too low, it takes you a long time to build back up. So they have to now spend a lot of time on two ways to refix some of the things that they did not capitalize on, like the hotels. And the second thing is they have to carefully build up their product price in order to make sure that they end up again in a level where they should be.
Do you think the deal with the hotels had anything to do with the underspending on the studios park?
That is most probably one of the reasons, because once you have such a debt load, it's very complicated to, you know, what a lot of people don't know, but where there's the parking lot right next to the Newport Bay, okay, there's a big parking lot right now. That's supposed to be the location of the third gate. So it's not only the one gate, it's the second. You're supposed to have a lot more critical mass as far as visitors is concerned before you have to build other hotels. But then, of course, you have to have also the capex available for it. And they really were held short of that because of their debt load problem.
Now, Charlie from Blue Loop has asked me not to ask you about Park 21 in Amsterdam. So what do you think about Park 21 then?
Well, I can say a few things about it. I think that, my opinion is known by all players that are involved in that, is that I think today when you do a park like that or a location like that, you should try to be different. You should have enough head turning capability in order to let it stand on its own. Now, if you build it right next to Schiphol and you build it right next to Amsterdam, you do basically the same as Disney did with Paris. You know, you move it next to a big tourist attraction, plus you have a lot of visitors in your country, then, you know, focus on one thing where you can benefit not only the local market, but you can also benefit the tourist. And in that view, I felt that whatever we built on a big project somewhere, there is one subject that is very scattered all over Holland, and for which we are still known very much in the world, is that the Dutch have developed a system to conquer the increase of the sea level and to conquer water coming in either through the rivers or from the sea. And we know what to do with that, and we have a very well built up system to manage that. And that is a know-how that could be used all over the world. Now, that is not a subject that is very interesting to talk about a lot. But the subject of how we protect ourselves against the sea and how we have been successful, like a Vasco da Gama, whoever, to go around the world and be, you know, with ships and be successful in trading. Those are two big stories that we can do a much better job of telling to the general public in a fun and a ludic way, an entertaining way. And if you add to that the flower market business that we're in, which is another very big product of Holland, if you bring those two together and make it a big focus on one location, whether it's Park 21 or anywhere else, then you'll have a lot of success. Now, if you start to add a lot of other gimmicks around it, then you've lost your focus. You know, today it still may turn out to be that case. But today there's a lot of other people that want to be involved, and they do the same thing that we do everywhere else. You create a shopping mall and you have a lot of different names and branches sticking together, and then you hope that a lot of people come. So the other thing is too, it's driven by a government agency at the moment, and it should be driven by private money. I've been known to be very direct on this subject in other meetings, but I think this is basically my feeling that I have.
You're due to leave Compagnie des Alpes any day now. Will you retire from the industry?
Not at all. I've been approached by several people to be involved in different things. And Karen Staley asked me yesterday also to stay around on the IAPA board situation, just to make sure that the company or the industry can benefit a little longer. Because, you know, I speak many languages. I've been in many countries. I understand a lot of countries, and I think it's a lot of fun to be in this industry, because basically what we do is whatever park we run, whatever zoo we run, whatever activity we do, whether it's a family entertainment center or whether it's a zoo or whether it's a park, small or big, we're all in the industry to make people happy. And in the happy-making industry, there's a lot of fun. And, you know, I realized that when I worked in the hotels in the Cheyenne, was after I opened the three hotels, I was manager director of the Newport Bay at Disney, and afterwards at the Cheyenne. And I'll tell you, we had many days and we had so many things happening in the hotel that you really wondered, what the hell am I doing here? And then what I would do then is to go to the park, park my car at the back, drive, walk in, and spend 2 or 3 hours just looking at happy faces of families and kids and say, that's why you do it all.
And what attractions do you like to visit with your own family to put a smile on their faces when you have the time?
Well, the family, my family is three daughters that are right by now between the 33 and 36. So they have, the oldest one has a family. There's a railway museum close to where my grandchildren live. And they love that. It's the museum where now Martin Foppen, who's the former director of the Delphian Army, goes to. It's called the Spoorweg Museum. It's the railway museum in Utrecht.
When he arrived as new managing director of Chester Zoo in 2013, one of the first things Jamie Crichton did was write a cheque for £40 million. That's about €55 million or $60 million. This summer, we'll find out what he's done with it. But first, we asked him why the zoo is the UK's number one. Hi, Jamie. Thanks for joining us. I think one people might not realise is that Chester Zoo is actually the largest zoo in the UK, isn't it? Bigger than London, certainly in terms of attendance. Why do you think that is?
A number of reasons. We're physically larger than London. I think because we're based on the edge of a city rather than being in the middle of a city like a number of other zoos in the UK, we've had the ability to be able to grow over time. Also foresight from our founder, George Mottershead, when he bought 10 acres of land and Oakfield House back in the 1930s. He gradually, over the next two or three decades, bought 550 acres of land. So the zoo sits in 110 of that 550, but we've actually got all that land to grow and develop into, which is part of our master plan and what we've been doing over the last few years. So that's helped us physically grow in terms of the size of the zoo, but from a visitor attendance. Yes, we've just announced our 2014 numbers and we finished on 1.43 million visitors, which is slightly more than London Zoo. But we do have a very loyal membership group. We have nearly 60,000 members now of our zoo, and they tend to come and visit us at least four or five times a year. So that helps our visitor numbers.
Now, you arrived at the zoo, it was just under 2 years ago, wasn't it?
That's it, July 2013, yes.
And this was your first job in the attractions industry, but I believe that your background in the travel sector broadly, it did help you, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I spent a number of years working in the airport industry and in other areas of transportation, worked in the ferry industry as well. If you look at airports and zoos, you'd think that they're very, very different animals, but they're actually, pardon the pun, but you know, they are very similar. They tend to be large expanses of land, lots of development opportunities, peaks and troughs of traffic, retail and catering, car parking are very important in a large zoo like Chester, as they are with an airport. A high degree of fixed assets, so you know, an airport still has to run on the same or very similar numbers of people if they have one passenger. They do if they have a million passengers, and a zoo is exactly the same. You know, we are a 365-day, 24-hour, 7-day-a-week operation at Chester Zoo. You know, animals need to be looked after on a daily basis and during the night, so we have people here all the time. And that's very similar to an airport as well. Airports tend to be villages of people who are working constantly. So there's lots of similarities between the two operations. Previously to that, I spent a lot of time within the core retail industry, in both retail and catering, and that's stood me in good stead coming here to Chester and the amount of ancillary revenue we need to make.
Okay, so tell us more about the islands, Jamie. This is a massive project coming up for you, isn't it, this season?
Yeah, it's a huge project. It opens in June of this year. It's around about a £40 million project when we'll have finished it in June. And it's an expedition around six Indonesian islands. We're currently putting the final stages of that together. We should have our principal contract off-site by the end of this month. And that gives us a period of months to get all the animals onto site, what we're calling an acclimatisation period, and technically test the site ahead of us opening in June. So it's a massive step change for us at Chester. Capital projects have never been any more than between 5 and 10 million here. We know it's the largest investment here in Chester, and we know it's the largest investment in any zoo in the UK. From a budgeting perspective, it's a combination of operating surplus. So it's money that we have taken and put away over the last few years from people who come and visit the zoo on a day-to-day basis, and partly it's been from an agreement with our banker. It's all set within a very stringent business plan. And that business plan allows us to be able to pay back the bank investment in a very, very short period. So we're very, very confident that this is going to be a massive success for us.
And how do you go about recreating seven Southeast Asian islands in Northwest England?
We do it through a combination of methods. Our architect, Dan Pullman, worked very, very hard at the whole concept around islands. We also have a number of companies that are helping us with theming, especially a German company called Cargo. We're currently on site at the moment theming all the rock work to make it look like the Indonesian islands that we're going to be showing. So there's that element. We've also got 13 themed bridges around site and 42,500 plants and trees that have been put in the ground as we speak, some of which are native to those islands. The Monsoon Forest Building, which is going to be the largest zoological building in the UK, we're at about 89, 90 degrees in heat, will be very typical of the types of surroundings in Indonesia, and we'll have some of the native species in there as well. So the whole combination of things. We've also got a number of containers coming from Indonesia where we've had a specialist company out there buying artifacts from the islands. So we've got tuk-tuks, we've got bikes, we've got boats, we've got smaller pieces of equipment which have come from villages and towns within Indonesia, which we're bringing back. So the whole thing is going to be fully themed to create this fully immersive experience.
Now, you're not the first zoo to incorporate elements of theme park, I guess, if we could say that, into this. You've got a Jungle River boat ride, is that right?
Yeah, we have a lazy boat trip. We try and stay clear of being labelled as a theme park. We want to be seen as a fully immersive visitor experience. And the whole idea behind that, we're a conservation and education charity, and it's extremely important for us to ensure that when our visitors leave Chester Zoo, they go away with a conservation and an education message. And the lazy boat trip is part of that because it gives our visitors the ability to be able to see the whole of the experience that they've just walked around from a totally different perspective, being in a boat, being closer to the animals, and to try and create for them what it would be like sailing down a river in Indonesia with these types of native species around them. You know, it's not a log flume or anything like that. It's a very slow boat trip around the island. We've got 14 themed boats, which have been specially made for us, which couldn't have been themed, which will look identical to similar boats out in Indonesia.
And where did you visit to get some of your inspiration for the islands project? Was it just to the zoos or theme parks or where?
A number of places. I mean, primarily, actually, Indonesia itself. We have a conservation team here who visit many countries. So lots of the inspiration and ideas about what we should do came directly from our own staff, our own field staff out in Indonesia, back here to Chester. We've then supplemented that with looking at what other zoos in and around the UK and Europe have done. And then you're quite right, from a visitor attraction perspective, we need to be able to look at other attractions in the UK and how they can deal with vast numbers of people.
You got just over the 1.4 million visitors last year. You're actually striving to get towards, is it 2 million with the Islands project?
Yeah, we opened Islands in June of this year, and we're budgeting for 1.6 million visitors this year, which I think is relatively conservative based on the size of expansion. Expansion's around 20%. Bigger than the current zoo. So it's a big old addition to the zoo. And it wouldn't surprise me if we then get past the 1.6 million and get to closer to 1.75 million over the next full year, 2016.
You actually got a lot of attention, didn't you, last year when Chester was the star of a BBC drama series called Our Zoo?
Yeah, about 5.5 million people watched it. Over the 8 or 9 weeks it was on during the autumn period. Great time of night, middle of the week. I think it just followed another big BBC programme. We started to conduct tours around Oakfield House, which I think we've now got booked out until June of this year. We've seen a big increase in visitor numbers. In fact, we've had record visitor numbers in September, October, November, December, January and February of the end of last year and the beginning of this year. And a lot of that has come about because of our zoo. So it's been great for the zoo, and we just wish that the BBC would have another series.
Now, just one final question. We're going to be asking this to everybody on the podcast. What attractions do you visit in your own time with your family when you get the time?
A whole variety of attractions. Zoos, as you'd expect me to say. We visit on a regular basis, not only here in the UK, but also abroad. Other attractions, probably attractions where they're doing something different. One of the experiences that we want to go and visit are the Harry Potter tours. And the reason we want to do that is we know that they've got a fantastic reputation. Their TripAdvisor scores are way over 90% for excellent, very good. And it's that company and those tours that we actually want to strive to be as good as, if not better. We also understand that they're building a new extension in the process of opening it very shortly. So we want to go and see what they're doing well and what we can bring back here to Chester Zoo.
Now, since we recorded that interview, it's been announced that the Islands project will in fact open on July the 13th. The good news is it'll be included within regular zoo admission. The price people pay, however, will vary according to when they visit. As Jamie explains.
We've actually just two or three weeks ago started something called flexible pricing, a bit like the pricing structure that you would have if you went and bought a low-cost airline ticket. Our prices will vary depending on what day you come to the zoo and whether it's going to be a busy day or a quiet day. So if you wanted to come and visit Islands on the first day it opens or on August bank holiday, you will pay more than you paid this year. If you came and visited us on an October weekday or on a April or May weekday, you'll probably pay slightly less than you paid this year. But we've seen a massive change in our booking habits since we launched it a couple of weeks ago. We only had about 20% of our visitors booking online before we introduced flexible pricing, and that shot up to over 50%, which gives us a much better handle on the business, more information about our visitors, and allows us to be able to resource our staff accordingly. So it's been a great success so far.
One of the things that affects ticket prices, of course, is tax. There's a big campaign in the UK at the moment to have a reduced rate of value-added tax on tourism, just like some other European countries. With the British general election just around the corner this May, we thought we'd ask Juliana Delaney what she thought the chances were of that happening. And then we speak to Jan Roovers for one last time, just to get a bit of perspective from elsewhere in Europe.
Well, look, I've been on record as saying that I think it's a very big ask to ask whatever government comes into power to reduce VAT on tourism. However, having read some of the manifestos, I think it is something that has now gained traction, and some of the parties are actually saying in their manifestos that they will consider it. So maybe it's not as big a ask as I thought it was.
Are you in favour?
The economic argument points to a greater return if that discount on VAT materialises. Yeah. Let's hope that's true.
This is a very hot subject from country to country. And there are countries that have moved it up in one shot right to the higher level, and it's been a problem for a year and a half, and then it settles out and things move on. In Holland today, we yell with the whole industry, not only the parks, but it's the horeca, hotel, restaurants, everybody that's into the service. They all have somewhere a 6% deal, whereas the rest of our added value tax is 19. At some point, there has been decided that all this tax, this added value tax, has to be one level for all the services. And many countries wiggled around and got themselves in between deals in order to politically, survive and sell it better. And Germany has been the leader in trying to get the same for everybody. 3, 4, 5 years ago, I think, they got faced all of a sudden with a huge lobby out of the hotel industry, and they were forced back down to 6%, whereas the rest of Germany is, I believe, in 19 or the 20 bracket. In most countries in Europe, the industries that are at the lower tax rate are fighting to keep it as long as they can. That's understandable, because in England there's a very strong lobby, that's correct. But at the end of the day, somehow you will lose that. Or they will have to lower the entire added value tax bracket, because the feeling is we're losing 55,000 jobs the minute that the added value tax will go up. So that's a strong argument. Now, there's people against and for that argument, but in essence, it will be a hit it will last a few years and it will come back, my opinion.
Jan Ruvers from Company Des Alpes there. Now, it wouldn't be a Blue Cast without checking in with Charlie Reed from Blue Loop. Here he is. Hi, Charlie. From one man with a face for radio to another, hello.
Hi, Owen. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for joining us. This is something we're going to be doing at the end of each podcast, and very exciting times for Blue Loop, I guess. You've just done the second Blue Loop Live conference in London. You've got another coming up in Hong Kong, which we'll talk about later. And just to give some people an idea of the dynamic way in which Blue Loop works, you and I first talked about doing a podcast about 2 years ago, didn't we?
Absolutely. It's bleeding edge technology, and we always try to be on the ball.
That's right. And then about a year ago, we got a pilot out, didn't we?
Absolutely.
And then here we are now with the first episode. Now, what we're going to be doing on each of these little chats is just giving people an idea of some of the latest stories and most interesting, most read things on the Blue Loop website. What should people look out for at the moment?
Well, Owen, right now we've got a report from the Fountain of Dreams show in Weishan in China. That was put on by the French company ECA2. We've got a report about that. We've got an interview with Sharon Redrobe from Twycross Zoo, who's transforming the zoo there. And there's a lot of interesting news on the site right now. We've got the opening of the Orlando Eye, a look at the Molkaten water park over in the Netherlands. So yeah, we've got a lot covered this month.
So Blue Loop Live in London was a big success, wasn't it, recently?
Absolutely. We had a packed audience. We had a really great lineup of speakers and a great part in the evening.
And you're doing one in Hong Kong in June. Just tell us what people can expect and why you're doing it when you are.
Absolutely. Well, we're doing it on Monday, June the 15th. And entirely by coincidence, IAPA have their own conference starting a couple of days later in the same city. So I would advise anyone going to our conference to also visit IAPA while they're in town.
Yeah, they should, shouldn't they, really? Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we've got a fantastic lineup of speakers. We've got Darren McLean, he's the CEO at Maps Perak in Malaysia. Tom Merman, Ocean Park, Hong Kong. Keith James, Jim Patterson, president of Ripley's, Matthew Pitty, Dubai Parks and Resorts, and we're adding further great speakers to the lineup as we speak. So it should be a really, really good day.
And that's on the Monday, and then the IAPA event starts Tuesday, Wednesday, doesn't it?
That's right. And the end of our event, we'll finish around 5. We've got a cocktail reception and drinks and a buffet in a room overlooking Hong Kong Harbour. I think it's pretty high up in the building, and there's a light show in the harbour. So it should be a really good day.
And if people want to book, what should they do?
Well, if they go to blueloop.com, at the top there's a link to Blue Loop Live. If they click that, they can find out details about the event and then book tickets as well.
But don't just take Charlie's word for it. Here's what a few people had to say at Blue Loop Live in London on May the 7th.
I'm Sandy Clark. I'm from The View from the Shard. I like to think of myself as a seasoned veteran of conferences. And I have to say, I thoroughly enjoyed the day today, the Blue Loop Live event. Fantastic pace, great speakers, and a really enjoyable event. All the sessions were very good, but I have to tip a nod to David Schneider. Fantastic stand-up comedy in a speech is always a good thing.
Hello, I'm Paul Carty. I'm the managing director of the Guinness Storehouse in Dublin. I really enjoyed today. I thought the session in particular on technology and on digital marketing was particularly useful, and I certainly picked up a few nuggets on that and things I'll be going back and talking to the team about when I go back, and we'll be following up on some learnings here today.
Yeah, I'm Peter Canales from Fontys Academy for Creative Industries in the Netherlands, and I love this Blue Loop Live conference because it's about very important things like experience and engagement. I think what they do with this is engage us, the industry, and connect us together. And that's, I think, the message.
And that's about it for this very first podcast from Blue Loop. Thanks very much for downloading, listening, and sticking with us right till the end of this very first episode. There will be more. Subscribe to Blue Talk on iTunes. That's BLLO, and then you won't miss the next episode. We're also on Audio Boom. In the meantime, for all things attractions, from museums to theme parks and everything in between, check out blueloop.com.